the evidence on Medicaid expansion and the quest to bring the decision to the voters. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Tuesday, August 3rd, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk about projected cost, health outcomes, and federal incentives to expand Medicaid. We'll also ask about ballot question fatigue and the energy behind a petition drive. Rick Weiland is with us. We explore the public land that is said to work for its keep. We talk with Ben Wudke of the Black Hills Forest Resource Association as we explore the forest for our August spotlight coverage. We also head east for a look at prairie grass restoration and west as we preview the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. Those stories are later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson. A Florida woman is facing multiple charges after police says they took her off a plane at the Rapid City Regional Airport for exposing herself and becoming unruly. According to the police, an officer at the airport was notified Friday night of a disruptive passenger who was exposing herself to others on the plane. The officer told the 41-year-old Daytona Beach Shores woman he would escort her off the plane. Police says she pulled away and kicked the officer. Additional officers arrived to take her out of the airport. She is facing charges of disorderly conduct, indecent exposure, assaulting a law enforcement officer, and unlawful occupancy. The pandemic is causing teacher shortages and other school staffing problems across the state. Two top education officials discussed the issue at a recent Sioux Falls Rotary meeting. SDPB's Jacqueline Severin reports.
State Education Secretary Tiffany Sanderson says every school district in South Dakota is dealing with staffing shortages for the upcoming school year.
The open positions right now going into the school year 3 weeks away, we still have almost 120 unfilled positions for classroom teachers.
Sanderson says some teachers decided to retire earlier than planned because of the COVID-19 pandemic. She says schools are also seeking additional staffing to help students who need one-on-one tutoring or special assistance to make up for lost learning because of the pandemic. Sioux Falls Superintendent Jane Stavem says her district is having trouble finding enough bus drivers and other support staff. Stavem says she is concerned about finding future teachers because many college students delayed graduation. She is also worried the pandemic has made college students rethink pursuing a teaching career.
The complexities that our staff dealt with and just the dailiness of teaching were immense, and it was very exhausting. And, you know, it's come and teach, but, you know, you have all these other things. If you were going into teaching, you might be thinking twice about that. We don't want to lose people from the profession.
Stavem says one way to recruit more teachers is to raise teacher salaries in South Dakota and across the country. The Sioux Falls School Board voted in May to raise the base pay for new teachers from $37,000 to $41,000. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jacqueline Severin.
Ellsworth Air Force Base near Rapid City has a new mask policy due to increased COVID-19 transmission and the Delta variant. The rules apply to unvaccinated and vaccinated people. Everyone must wear a mask while inside buildings on the base. Active duty personnel will also have to wear masks off base if social distancing can't be maintained. Ellsworth says the off-base rule is due to the increased numbers of visitors in the Black Hills area. An American Red Cross chapter in South Dakota is getting a new emergency response vehicle. The truck is outfitted to respond to multiple types of disaster. Patty Brooks is the executive director of the Eastern South Dakota chapter. She says the new truck helps fulfill the organization's mission.
To be able to have an herb, and so we can deploy that anywhere in a matter of hours if we get it stocked and situated and people to drive the herb. So it's just exciting to be able to help where help is needed.
The purchase of the vehicle is funded by donations. Brooks says the vehicle includes improved safety features and ergonomic systems to help volunteers distribute food, clean up supplies, and other essential relief items. The Eastern South Dakota chapter responded to 105 disaster instances last year. With South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota's confirmed COVID cases are on the rise ahead of the Sturgis motorcycle rally. 58% of state residents, however, have received at least one COVID vaccine. Well, how will the rally intersect with public health officials' vaccination and infection mitigation goals? Dr. Shankar Kaur is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health, and he's joining us from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio for an update. Dr. Kaur, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here, Lori.
So last year at this time, all eyes were on the Sturgis gathering. This year, it promises to be even bigger with fewer mitigation efforts, large public gatherings. Tell me a little bit about what has changed since last year, though, because we're looking at a very different scenario.
Yes, a lot has changed. We are not in the same place as we were last year. Like you correctly pointed out, at least 58% of the state's population has had at least one dose of the vaccine. And, you know, we are better, but we're not safe. A good example would be the CDC's publication of their study in Provincetown, Massachusetts, where they had 4th of July celebrations, and then it extended on through like the next week or two. They found close to 850 cases of COVID-19, of which a vast majority, two-thirds, were vaccinated folks that got the disease. The good news is none of them died. None of them required serious medical intervention. It was just a handful, five of them, that needed hospitalization, and all of them had other comorbid conditions, and they were eventually released from the hospital. So it proves two things. Vaccines work, and vaccines prevent severe disease and death. The only thing that we need to be extremely concerned with the Provincetown study published by the CDC is if we, like in Provincetown, Sturgis rallies attracting folks from all over the country. There were more than 20 states, people from 20 states in Massachusetts. So we can expect a similar situation. The question then is, in Massachusetts state, they had close to 70% at least receiving one dose of the vaccine. And we are below 60, and that is the difference. So we might, I wouldn't be surprised at all, this disease, we will see a rise in numbers after the rally, and probably within 10 days, just like in Provincetown, 10 days from the first event, they had a surge of cases. We will see that. The question then remains, how many of those folks' cases we see are vaccinated cases? Because the ones that are not vaccinated will end up in the hospital requiring ICU care and unfortunately may even succumb to the disease.
For people who have been vaccinated versus, on the other hand, people who've had COVID, does the Delta variant treat those people's immunity differently? Do you see what I'm asking there?
Yes, great question. Yes, so if you've got the vaccine, it doesn't matter if you got the Johnson & Johnson or either of the two mRNA vaccines, the Moderna or the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, you are protected in one important sense. You will not suffer the consequences of severe disease and death. So those are the two things that vaccination confers against the Delta variant. If you're not vaccinated, unfortunately, your natural immunity is not up to the task, and this variant can cause havoc. In other words, you will require medical intervention in the ICU, or worse still, death.
People are asking, once they have symptoms, they're in the hospital, they're asking their healthcare providers for the vaccine. And the healthcare providers are saying, it's too late for it right now. Talk to me about getting your vaccine if you have symptoms before. Help explain that for us, please.
Yeah, it's very important to get the vaccine before you develop the disease or symptoms of the disease. So the vaccine, the way it works is very, to put it very simply, it primes your immune system to be ready with targeted antibodies. Think of it as targeted bullets or against the virus. So you're ready, and even the smallest load of virus will not become multiply in your body and take over your body. If you're not vaccinated, when the virus gets in, it starts multiplying rapidly. It creates millions of copies, and we call it viral load. And then once it gets a certain critical point, it overwhelms every organ in the body, and worst of all, the lungs. But that's what you cannot prevent once you get the disease, because the vaccine, it takes time to work. It takes, as you can see, we say 2 weeks after your last dose of the vaccine series is when you're truly protected. So it takes a minimum of 2 weeks for the vaccine to work, to get your immune system to recognize the invader.
What efforts is Monument Health making to reach people at the rally? Can you take a vaccine truck out there? Can you take testing equipment out there? What's the plan?
Yeah, so we are very ready. We have testing readily available for anyone. The vaccine, however, we cannot do it out of a truck because you have to have a 15-minute observation period, making sure that they don't have any, you know, reactions. It's rare. Those reactions are extremely rare, but we can do it in a controlled setting. So we have that available, but not in off a truck. It's in a physical location in Sturgis and elsewhere in the Black Hills, like we've been doing all along.
Yeah. Dr. Shankar Kaur, we appreciate your time very much today. Thanks once again for being here.
Thank you, Lori.
Ahead on the program, the nature and nurture of a national forest. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
Sometimes just this simple. Sometimes life is just this simple. Sometimes life is really just this simple. I love my dog.
We answer complex philosophical questions each week. I'm Larry Gross. It's Mountain Stage, live performance radio from NPR.
Listen Saturday evening at 6, 5 Mountain, and Sundays at noon, 11 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by the Museum and the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center and Pier. Now offering free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. Learn more by calling the Cultural Heritage Center or visit history.sd.gov.
SDPB's Fiddles and Friends returns this August with 3 live concerts. Enjoy music from talented fiddlers including Kenny Putnam, Tom Schaefer, and Owen DeYoung. Join us in Watertown on August 26th. Sioux Falls on August 27th or on August 28th in Rapid City. Help support SDPB and get your tickets today by going to sdpb.org/fiddles. Sponsored by Crisp Row Hospitality and First Bank and Trust.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting this year's One Book South Dakota, The Children's Blizzard by Melanie Benjamin. Learn more about her virtual author tour and in-person Festival of Books appearance at sdhumanities.org.
Business and community development reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. This month, SDPB shines the spotlight on the Black Hills National Forest. We'll explore the history of the forest going back before European exploration. We'll travel along with the Custer Expedition for a look at how the forest has changed. We talk wildfires past and wildfires as they unfold. Today, as part of our spotlight coverage, we welcome Ben Wuttke with the Black Hills Forest Resource Association. He's joining us for a look at how the Black Hills National Forest is publicly owned, federally administered, and how all of that intersects with the forest products industry. Ben, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I should say, joining us from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Let's talk a little history first in the fact that this national forest status is from the 1900s before it was a forest reserve status, and those are different. This is not a forest reserve. Explain to our listeners what exactly a national forest designation means from a federal perspective.
Absolutely. Thank you, Laurie. And yes, you're right. It was a forest reserve at one point in time, and then the Organic Act really changed that. That was an amendment by Senator Pettigrew from South Dakota, interestingly. And the Organic Act really changed it from a preserve or a set-aside type of status to a resource that should be managed and cared for in perpetuity to provide goods for the people of the United States.
Tell me a little bit about how this public land works for a living, as it is said.
Well, gosh, anybody in the Black Hills area will tell, you know, Sturgis Week and tourism, it's a huge draw. Lots of folks come to the Black Hills to see the beauty of it. Big center for recreation, tourism, but it also plays a major role in our communities and the sustainability of our communities from forest products. And the forest products companies not only support the jobs to keep the communities going, but they also are the tool to manage and care for the forest. Being a disturbance-driven ecosystem, it requires constant management.
Tell me a little bit about what makes the Black Hills National Forest biologically unique.
Well, you don't find a lot of other national forests that are nearly pure ponderosa pine or one tree species. We're kind of an island in the plains out here. Many forests have borders that share others, but we're sitting all by ourselves out here. And ponderosa pine forests, like I mentioned, are frequent disturbance forests in the sense that fires, mountain pine beetles, they play a very regular role historically in the forests. And if you've ever seen some of the photos from the Custer expedition, you'll know that the landscape looked very, very different in the late 1800s than it does now. What we do here now is we mimic those disturbances as part of the management of the Black Hills National Forest. But we do so where you can pinpoint and decide which trees and what type of disturbance you want versus some of the wildfires we're seeing in other western states or mountain pine beetle epidemics that have wiped out nearly entire national forests.
So let's get to the meat of sort of this tension that you often hear between forest products industry representatives and conservationists. And this goes back to the federal regulations that we talked about before. You're legally prevented from over-harvesting the forest. Tell us a little bit about the mandate to not deplete the forest. How does that all play out?
Well, it plays out in a complicated fashion, to be honest. Yeah. And I'm not sure we'd have the time to really get into all those details. But yes, you're correct. There are rules and regulations in place that ensure the sustainable management of the Black Hills National Forest. And part of that sustainability, too, is desired conditions and what the forest really should look like. You mentioned that the tension between forest products interests and, more preservation type of organizations. And when it comes down to it, we're both advocating for what we view as the best path and best future for the Black Hills National Forest. Some other groups see that path as growing the forest back to the same conditions that gave us the mountain pine beetle epidemic and large wildfires in the early 2000s. We advocate for constant management and care of the national forest to reduce the risks of another mountain pine beetle epidemic or the risk of hazards associated with having another wildfire on the landscape here. So a little bit different views, but I think we're both after the same thing.
Yeah, so that goes back to what you were saying before about just the frequent disturbance. So do I understand you correctly that you're saying, you know, these disturbances are going to happen, we're going to create the disturbance before the actual disturbance happens. We're going to thin the forest before the wildfire comes, or we're going to manage the pine beetle before the worst damage is done. Do I understand kind of what you're saying clearly?
Absolutely. And I would argue that it's in a much friendlier manner to the forest. Again, there's all those rules and regulations in place that really protect the forest during management activities. And, we will have more mountain pine beetles. We will have fires. You cannot stop fires from starting on the landscape. But our choice is in the scale and severity of those events. And we can take proactive actions to reduce the scale and severity of mountain pine beetles and wildfires here in the Black Hills.
Yeah. Can you explain to us the shelter wood / seed tree system? Like when we talk about, I don't want people to have the impression that it's, clear cutting a whole space and then planting a bunch of trees until they grow back. Tell me a little bit about how the forest is managed in the places that you've decided to cut for timber.
Sure. Well, we as an industry don't decide to cut timber on the Black Hills National Forest. That's all
fair,
marked
yeah.
and planned and done through a scientific process by the Black Hills National Forest. We do help landowners, private landowners, where they're interested in selling timber and harvesting timber. Forest products companies really take over the management on the private lands. But there are a number of different silvicultural systems. That's really the care of the trees. Being silviculture, and there's many different silvicultural systems that are employed in the Black Hills. Clear cutting generally is not one of them, and anybody who's been in the Black Hills long enough has seen a lot of areas that have been harvested, and they see the trees that remain. They see they're a little more spaced out, a little more resilient to insects and wildfires, and they see that the understory, that the grasses and shrubs respond, wildlife come in more. They get what we do here in the Black Hills. Sometimes that looks a little bit different, but generally speaking, it's all with the idea of keeping a forest on the landscape now and in the long term.
Yeah. For people who say that you're not listening to the scientists about what will happen in the future with the current pace of harvesting, what is your response to that?
Well, we're absolutely listening, but they and other people really need to understand the applicability of that most recent report out from the Forest Service. And it compares standing timber inventory now to previous reports, such as 1999 report, but it only looks at about 60% of the forest area that previous reports looked at. So, you know, I could say here with a straight face that Rapid City has a population of 40,000 people if I choose to ignore the other half of the city and pretend it doesn't exist. And so this report is something that I think is an interesting look. It's a very early look at the forest planning process, but it only applies to a small portion of the forest. And it only looks at certain pieces of even Forest Service data. And so there's a lot more Forest Service information that they didn't incorporate into that report that's very helpful and paints a very different picture than what that report did. So if you want to look at the science, which we and everyone else should, you have to look at all of the science. You can't selectively look at it. And unfortunately, that's what I feel that a lot of people are doing is they've latched on to one report, one aspect of it, but there's so much more than this one report. And if I could just take one more second, I'd say that the Black Hills National Forest Advisory Board, it's one of two boards in the nation that are approved to give formal advice and recommendations to the Forest Service. They also undertook the same process and looked at Forest Service data with the help of the Forest Service and came up with their own recommendation to the Black Hills National Forest. And that was not to reduce the sale program below the allowable sale quantity or the ceiling, if you will, of timber that can be sold out of the Black Hills National Forest under the current forest plan. And they also identified additional timber resources on the landscape that would allow for the forest to increase the timber sale program. So again, you know, that group spent 7 months analyzing that data, a very, very close look at that information. And looking at the science, you have to look at all of it. You have to look at the whole picture, which I don't think is getting a fair shake.
One more question before I let you go. When we think of closing a sawmill, we often think of the people who are out of work, or we think of a product that we might not have as a consumer. When you close a sawmill, are you also losing a resource for forest management?
Absolutely. It's been heartbreaking to hear the stories of the sawmill employees and harvesters who work in the woods and the impacts to their families. But our concern as an industry is really first and foremost the future management and care of this forest. We as an industry have been around since the very first ever federal timber sale, which occurred in the Black Hills in 1899. We've played an integral role on caring for this forest and implementing the treatments that need to take place on the landscape. And anytime you lose that infrastructure, you're losing the ability to do those treatments on a meaningful scale.
You can find all our Black Hills National Forest coverage as it unfolds on our website. We're going to have all kinds of things there and explainers for what exactly the forest is and where it is and the reports that we're talking about here. So if we talked a little bit above your head today, you can go online to sdpb.org/spotlight and find some background reporting already present there. And we want you to be part of this coverage. Tell us the stories that you think are most essential to understanding the Black Hills National Forest. You can call and leave a message at 605-951-0740. Send us a direct message on Twitter. I'm at @MomentSDPB, and you can email inthemoment@sdpb.org. Ben Wudke represents the Black Hills Forest Resource Association, and thank you so much for being here with us today. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
Ahead on the program, the battle over Medicaid expansion and the challenge of bringing the decision to the voters. You're listening to The Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Carl Gerke, and coming up this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear a suite of early Duke Ellington compositions from trumpeter Bruce Harris, along with another new interpretation of Ellington from the Mark Masters Ensemble, featuring trombonist Art Barron, who played in Ellington's last band. Plus, we'll have classic music from pianist Earl Garner, whose centennial we're celebrating this summer. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
South Dakota Home Garden offers more opportunities for you to learn during South Dakota's short but sweet growing season. SDPB makes it easier by sharing gardening advice across all our platforms. Join us on TV, radio, and online at sdpb.org/sdhomegarden to keep your gardening ideas fresh this season.
As part of our Early Learners Initiative, or ELI, SDPB presents Parenting Minutes. These bite-sized videos for parents and caregivers have useful everyday tips for raising curious and confident learners. There's always time to learn. Watch for Parenting Minutes on SDPB TV or visit us online at sdpb.org/ELI. And don't forget to sign up for our ELI newsletter.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. A statewide survey from South Dakota Public Broadcasting and the Cheeseman Center for Democracy asked participants whether they would support the expansion of Medicaid in the state. More than 52% said definitely yes. Another 20% said probably yes. Well, South Dakota is one of about a dozen states that has not adopted Medicaid expansion, which was part of the original Affordable Care Act. Opponents argue expanding coverage leaves too much decision-making in the hands of the federal government. They also cite concerns about the potential price tag. Well, a group of South Dakotans are seeking to put the issue to voters in 2022 with a Medicaid expansion ballot question. Rick Weiland represents South Dakotans for Health, and he's joining me in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio for an update. Welcome back, Rick. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be back.
I want to start with this, you know, who does it benefit? Who is Medicaid expansion affect? Who's it for?
Well, there are about 42,500 South Dakotans that are currently uninsured, and they're trying to figure out how to put a roof over their head and food on the table and simply cannot afford private insurance, and they don't get any help with the Affordable Care Act in terms of any kind of subsidy. So that's the choice that they have to make. And, you know, many of these folks are working three or four part-time jobs, and it's a choice they have to make. And this would essentially provide them coverage through an expanded Medicaid program. We think it makes a lot of sense in terms of not only our responsibility to our neighbors, but also financial implications. I mean, you know, we've left, since the Affordable Care Act was passed, several billion dollars on the table that other states are accessing all around us: Montana, North Dakota, Iowa, Minnesota, Nebraska recently voted to expand Medicaid. And it's like, you know, our elected officials just didn't take the time to read the memo. I mean, we could, you know, literally cover 42,500 people who, you know, do get sick. But when they get sick, they go into the emergency room and they get acute care. When they don't get their preventative medicine like a colonoscopy or a mammogram. It usually shows up in a terrible situation where now they require absolute, you know, acute care, which is hundreds of times more expensive than preventing the disease from occurring in the first place, or catching it in time to where you're not dealing with stage four colon cancer. So this is a no-brainer. It's inexcusable that we haven't done this. We've had an opportunity since 2012. Most states, as you pointed out in your opening remarks, have expanded Medicaid. We're one of 12 states that have not, and that's why we're on the streets and have been since last November collecting signatures. And it's really interesting because it's hard to get anybody that doesn't sign the petition. You know, very few people walk away and say they don't support this. So the legislature hasn't done it. There was an attempt by Governor Dugard, and I give him a lot of credit for it, but he couldn't get the legislature to go along with him. So that's why these initiatives are important.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in here because Governor Dugard, when he was on this program, said it would be cost neutral for the state of South Dakota's budget. The opposition that he was talking about was when you ask people if they want Medicaid expansion, they say yes. When you ask them if they want Obamacare implemented, they said no way. So he was trying to overcome, as my memory, if my memory serves me accurately with that interview, this sort of attachment with the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare back in the day. But he was saying it was cost neutral at that time. Is it still cost? What do we know about how much it would cost?
Right. The federal government picked up 100% of the cost. And then they gradually, based on the law, moved that down to 90%. So yeah, we're at a 90-10 right now. But President Biden, with the rescue plan that he signed off on in February, added an additional incentive for states that haven't expanded, 5%. Each year for 2 years, which is another almost $100 million that goes towards paying for the program. So we're going to be at 95% for 2 years, and then we'll go to 90%. But the fact of the matter is, what fiscally minded elected official wouldn't invest a dollar of our tax dollars to get 15 back? And that's what we're talking about here. It's almost $300 million federal tax dollars, our tax dollars, that we get back to South Dakota. For every dollar that we put in, it's 15 in return. It doesn't make any sense. And what I'm afraid to happen again is it's become political. I mean, you hear the opposition talk about, well, these are able-bodied people, they should just go get a job. Well, in Montana, 95% of the people we've worked with, the state of Montana, to better understand their program, 95% of those people are either working one, two, or three jobs, or taking care of disabled children or disabled relatives. They're legitimate, and they should not be forced in the situation to where they have to get so sick to get medical care. This goes all the way back, where we've talked about cost shifting that goes on, the uncompensated care that hospitals have to eat that gets shifted to private pay people, where we're paying higher copays, higher premiums. This is the right thing to do. And it's our money. We should take it back. Everybody else got the memo surrounding us, but we did and didn't read it.
What do we know about health outcomes from Medicaid expansion states? Kaiser's done a research.
Oh,
I was digging through there.
Yeah,
interesting.
I mean,
stuff.
It's phenomenal, the difference. You know, can you imagine, you know, what 50-year-old now that's working, say, in the food service industry, trying to make ends meet, is going to put down the money for a colonoscopy when they hit 50 years of age? They don't get that kind of preventative care because they can't afford it. And then they get sick, you know, and then we have to pay, you know, a lot of money to deal with their disease. We can preempt that. There was a doctor on not that long ago on a talk show I was listening to that was talking about we should be doing preventative care and avoiding acute care, because acute care costs a heck of a lot more money. And that's what you get when you expand Medicaid. People have access to mammograms. They have access to colonoscopies. They have access to prescription drugs. And they should have access.
In some states, the opposition from the state GOP has, you know, is declining, and you're seeing states like Georgia, you know, kind of talking about this a little bit more, maybe being more open to Medicaid expansion. You're saying, South Dakota, that's not the case? Are we seeing the state lawmakers be more open to this? Because I want to get, in our remaining minute or so, to this idea of why this has to be a ballot question instead of why it should come from the South Dakota state legislature.
Well, they've just refused to do it. It's unfortunate. Wyoming almost did, a state to our, the only state that borders us that doesn't have Medicaid expansion. They had a change of heart, but they couldn't get it through both chambers to get it done last, their last legislative session. I don't think you're going to see it happen here in South Dakota legislatively. And that's why we have this initiative process. But they keep trying to make it more difficult too, Lori, to do these kinds of things. We're now having to deal with House Joint Resolution 5003, which is now going to be on the June 2022 primary ballot, which will require legislation or initiatives like Medicaid expansion to hit a supermajority of 60+%. Now, you and I both know primary ballots, you know, there aren't a lot of voters for the most part that even turn out to vote. It's less than 26-27%. I can tell you there are a lot fewer Democrats that vote in primaries because Democrats don't have primaries. We struggle to get candidates. So they put it on a primary ballot for two reasons. One, because they know the turnout numbers. And two, if it passes in November or in June of 2022, it will affect Medicaid expansion. If it were on the general election ballot, where most people vote, it wouldn't, even if it passes, affect Medicaid expansion. And I know the proponents of that spoke openly about it. We're doing this because we want to nix Medicaid expansion.
What's your message to voters who are frustrated with ballot questions being approved and then never going to affect in the way that the voters intended, who are losing enthusiasm and have a little ballot question fatigue? Why should I sign your petition? Why should I show up and vote for this? Even if it passes by 60-70%, we're not going to see it happen because the voters can't do this over the will of the state legislature.
We're seeing this in cannabis right now, but turn the clock back. We saw it on minimum wage in 2014. That passed. The legislature went in and tinkered with it and said young people can't get it. We had to refer that to the voters. When we did, it passed.
So can voters do this?
Can they what?
Can they pass Medicaid?
Yes,
or is
they can.
Just going to be a,
no, absolutely.
Can they pass Medicaid expansion without a lawsuit that turns around and flips and changes the intent?
You can't prevent anybody from filing a lawsuit. You can't prevent the governor from going into court on recreational cannabis. But, you know, you don't always win in the courts, and we'll see how it plays out in South Dakota. But this is a constitutional amendment that we're advancing, and it's very hard for them to unwind that. You do a legislative initiative like we did with IM-22, the Anti-Corruption Campaign Finance Reform Act, because they tried to override the voters on minimum wage and they got in trouble because the voters overwhelmingly rejected their changes and young people did get the benefit. They tried to do it with IM-22, but they found a way out of letting the voters refer. And they declared a state of emergency because the voters supported an anti-corruption campaign finance reform act. I mean, I'm not making this stuff up. And that's what they did. So we couldn't refer it. So they locked the voters out from being able to refer their action. Medical marijuana passed by over 70%. They're slow to the start in getting it implemented. But it ultimately, I think, will get implemented. Not sure what will happen with cannabis, recreational cannabis. But, you know, this initiative process is really in the Cheeseman Institute, which you pointed out. 70% of the people polled in that survey said it's an important part of our democracy and the legislature should stop screwing with it.
Rick Weiland is with South Dakotans for Health. We're going to have more on Medicaid expansion and the nuances of it in the days ahead. We'll put a link up to some resources on our website at sdpb.org/news in today's show notes. Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Let's take a moment now to consider the intimate history of a family home. What began as a summer roofing gig 20 years ago led Sioux Falls native John Cook to a career in restoring neglected historic homes and then managing those properties as a landlord. Let's listen as he walks through a 1923 home he recently restored near the Sioux Falls Cathedral Historic District. He's talking here with Laura Rohde, reporting for SDPB.
I'm lucky I fell into something. I didn't know that I was going to be a contractor restorer in college. I had no idea what I was doing. I was just rolling around campus going to classes. And in 2001, I came back. My dad had a little bit of real estate, asked me if I wanted to shingle a rental property. And I said, sure. And I read the instructions on how to roof a house. It took me 2.5 weeks. He owned the one next door, asked if I'd do that one, shingle that. And then a hailstorm came through, and people started calling, my phone started to ring. Next thing you know, by the end of that summer, I had made like 5 times more than I ever did at any other job, and I had a great time doing it. And so I went to a lawyer, and I got a trailer. I called it John Cook Construction, and that was kind of the start of it. I'm just passionate about just the way they used to build stuff. Like, I just don't like how houses are built in 4 or 6 months now. It's just like, you know, when you go into developments where all of them look the same, it's kind of, I get sick to my stomach. Like this, I like the eclectic neighborhoods, character, a mixture of people. When I see these things, every single property almost, I can like see the end result. And like when I get a vision in my head, it gets really expensive because I have to follow through with it. Well, so if you come in here, and someone might have come in here and looked around and been like, oh, we can do new countertops, paint, and, you know, new light fixtures, like lipstick, you know. And that isn't going to work in the long haul. And you're not going to get the type of tenants that you want, because this is what we do for a living, and we own, we have to manage these. And, you know, so I always kind of just say, like, I want to do this place like it's something I would want to move into.
Ahead on the program, Regenerating the Grasslands, we preview this year's Dakota Conference at the Center for Western Studies. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Jane Clayson. Black women earn just 62 cents for every dollar a white man makes, a pay gap that adds up to a wealth gap.
At the end of their lives, they are sometimes left with very meager savings or no savings at all. So they are shortchanged into retirement.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by First Dakota National Bank. Every timeless institution, tradition, and thriving business was started somewhere by someone who had a dream. Here's to those who made it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
On the next Fresh Air, collaborating with Stephen Sondheim on 3 musicals, we talk with James Lapine. He wrote the book for the shows Sunday in the Park with George, Into the Woods, and Passion, and directed the original Broadway productions. His new book is a behind-the-scenes look at the creation of Sunday in the Park. Join us. This afternoon at 2, One Mountain, on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Sanford Underground Research Facility, hosting world-leading research in physics and other disciplines. Learn more about America's Underground Science Laboratory at sanfordlab.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The 53rd Annual Dakota Conference gets underway this Thursday on the campus of Augustana University in Sioux Falls. The theme of this year's conference is farming, ranching, and sustainability on the Northern Plains. On the schedule for Thursday is Luke Zilverberg, a prairie ecologist for EcoSun Prairie Farms based in Brookings. The title of Zilverberg's presentation is Recreating History Through a Tall Grass Prairie Restoration, and Luke joins us now on the phone. Hey, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori. I'm happy to be here.
All right. As we preview a little bit of your presentation and give people just a hint of it, we're going to start at Good Earth State Park. Why there?
Yeah, so we are doing our restoration project at Good Earth State Park, and that's right outside of Sioux Falls. in between Sioux Falls and Harrisburg, right on the Big Sioux River, and on the other side of Good Earth, on the Iowa side, is also that Blood Run territory. So that is, if anyone has ever been there listening to this, it's a terrific site. The walking trails, the visitor center is really something spectacular, and it's just a really good spot to be. And the Native Americans around that 1500 to 1715 time frame, the Oneota people lived there and really lived off the land. They had native prairies surrounding them. They had the Big Sioux River, which was a riparian zone, so they had all the benefits of wildlife traveling through the by the river, and then they had wild bison in the area. So it was really taken up by the Oneota people. And then the big or the Sioux Native Americans came in and really drove the Oneota south. And then around that 1715 time, or the 1850s is when European settlement started to happen, and the landscape really started to change forever. With farming, and the native prairie started to decrease. And there's historic studies out there and numbers that say the tallgrass prairie was once 142 million acres. And now in South Dakota, we're down to 1 to 2% of remnant true tallgrass prairie left.
All right. So let's talk about this very difficult conversation about restoration, regeneration. How do you approach this ecosystem and say, we start here?
Yeah, so the Game Fish and Parks, which is in charge of the Good Earth State Park site, has worked with EcoSun, and they had 107 acres that was part of their park, but it was being farmed with corn and soybeans. And so EcoSun now has been put in charge of restoring this 107 acres back into native tallgrass prairie. And so that's how it basically started. And so this spring, we've planted the site with five different plant communities. We have a tallgrass mix, which is very diverse. We have about 50 to 60 different flowers and forbs. And then we have a mid-height mixed grass tallgrass prairie. And then we have three other sites where we have more of a monoculture, but yet the tall grasses, the big blue stem, the Indian grass, and the switchgrass. And throughout that 107 acres, it'll be just a very diverse site where it's very rare in South Dakota where the public can come and visit true tallgrass prairie. So this will be open to the public where people can walk through. There's going to be walking trails throughout this site, and people can really come see what historic tallgrass prairie was like, and it's similar to what it was way back when the Native Americans lived there.
Okay, so as you, as a prairie ecologist, as you're doing this work, you're watching it transform. You're thinking about how to interpret and explain this to people who are just out for a nice Sunday, you know, walk in the park. And you're also dealing with this history of, you know, people who came centuries before you. Tell me a moment where, I don't know, you heard it sound different, or you smelled it differently, or some kind of part of your work that, when you can step back from the science and just experience a moment of transition and optimism.
Yeah. So when it's in corn and soybeans, it's a monoculture. And so it provides habitat for maybe one or two species. But when we transform and convert it back to native prairie, we're providing so many ecosystem services for wildlife, for the pheasants, for the deer, for the small mammals, the insects, all the flowers that are available for pollination. So when I'm out there now, there is pheasant chicks running around everywhere. We had a coyote run through the other day. We have deer in there. There's all sorts of different insects, bees, butterflies, flies. And it's just really, if you take a step back and really look at what's going on, it's something special. In the first year of restoring prairie, it's a different task. It's called the weed stage. So that first year is very weedy, and about 2 or 3 years in is when everything really starts to come up. So it's in that first year, but in 2 to 3 years when the walking trails are finished and people start to walk through, they're going to really look at the wildlife and insects that are in this area. And maybe if they just close their eyes and like you said, listen or smell, it'll be very special to them. And
Luke Silverberg, thank you for being here today. The presentation is called Recreating History Through a Tall Grass Prairie Restoration, and it is part of the 53rd Annual Dakota Conference at the Center for Western Studies. You can hear Luke's presentation at 5 local time Thursday in Fantle Room 108, and that's at Augie. The entire schedule, you can find it online, augie.edu/Dakota-conference. Luke, thanks for being here. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Lori. Look forward to talking on Thursday.
Listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Michael Lichter began photographing custom bikes and the biker lifestyle in the 1970s. He worked with Easy Rider magazine since 1979 and has produced more than 800 stories for them. Lichter is also a regular contributor to 16 other publications around the world. He's got 11 coffee table books to his credit, and he exhibits his photographic art in galleries and in museums in the USA and abroad. As a curator, he first started creating themed exhibitions with custom motorcycles and arts in 2001 at the Journey Museum in Rapid City. In 2009, the annual exhibition was moved to the purpose-built 7,000-square-foot gallery at the Sturgis Buffalo Chip, where it was given the name Motorcycles as Art. And this year's exhibit opens this Saturday. It runs through Wednesday, August 11th from 2 to 10 each day. And Michael Lichter is with us on the phone now. Michael, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about, okay, first of all, starting back in the 1970s, this lifestyle and custom bikes and the people who ride them has got to have changed a ton. So tell me a little bit about, take us back a little bit and tell me what's different then from now.
Well, for starters, this year's exhibition has a lot to do with that because it's called More Metal, Motorcycles and Art That Never Quit. So this year's exhibition is for the builders that have been in the business 20 or more years, and some have been in the business 50 years building custom bikes. And then I'm putting my photography on the walls this year, which I do just every 5 years. So I've curated this exhibition for 21 years, and every year the theme changes, and sometimes it's about who the participants are, sometimes it's about a style of bike. But this year it's more about the participants and that they have the moxie and wherewithal to still be doing it. So as for where it was, when I came up here in the 70s, you know, I was a 25-year-old, and I just came up to basically party for the weekend, and that's what we did. And that's when you saw the T-shirts, to hell with the races, we came to party, which is another big change. I think people are coming back and really enjoying the racing again, so a lot of changes. But, you know, when we first came up, we were camped out in City Park, and, of course, that only lasted a few years till 82. But we were not thinking about a motorcycle industry or a custom bike industry. There really wasn't one at the time. And magazines were pretty new and had a big impact. And we all followed them. And I just came up. I was a photographer at the time taking pictures. And I loved taking pictures of what I did and what I saw. And so I started photographing that very first rally. It was 1979. And, you know, at that time, I think people really came and made their own fun. You know, they just did what they did. We went out and raced on Highway 79 that goes north past the Buffalo Chip. And literally, we'd somebody be out in the street, and if they saw a car 2 miles away, we'd shut it down. And otherwise, they'd get back on the bikes and be literally having nitrous bikes out on the highway and not a cop to be seen. And, of course, the speed limit right in that area where we used to race is now 35 miles an hour and patrolled heavily by police and with a lot of traffic on it. So, I mean, that's the change. It's a change in what's happening in America, too. There's more people. things have gotten a little bit more, I think not a little, a lot more conservative. And now I think the fun is provided. You sort of pay to entry events with concerts everywhere, racing everywhere. And I think that's a lot of the changes.
Yeah. Have the bikes changed too? When you're looking for custom built, are there different trends that you're seeing now? Are we looking at a throwback era? Are there innovations that are pushing the artistry of custom building forward?
It's changed drastically. For one thing, I think the quality is just outrageous now. It's become so fine-tuned and really artful. At the time, it was also, I've always described custom bike building as really a sort of a home artistry for anybody at home, that they do it for the love of it. There's no sign of reward, and your biggest reward was bragging rights down at the local bar. That was about it. And now, you know, people are getting famous from it. There's people like Jesse James that have made big careers and big money through custom biking, and the industry is built up to distribution companies and parts companies, things like that. And consequently, there's more people that can build custom bikes. You can get off-the-shelf parts to do it, and you don't have to do as much yourself as you did in, let's say, the 70s. But now what's happened, I think, is we've gotten back to the artfulness where people are really building every part. I mean, I know people now that make their own bolts for the bikes, and they don't feel it's complete unless they've made all their own bolts. They shape their own gas tanks from raw metal, pounding it with hammers or in presses, things like that. They shape them, and they make their own frame. So it's really come a full circle, but now the quality is so much more. And part of that could be technology, too, that people have YouTube and communication devices, right, that they can talk to each other and learn from each other. So it's really phenomenal where we are now.
Yeah, you have 3D printing, which could give you an idea for the shape of something in the future that would help you get that,
you know,
get a start. Yeah.
I've seen a little bit of that. But really, a lot of it is getting back to working with your own hands.
Right.
Just a hammer and shaping it. And I think that's true for a lot of things. Younger people are saying, you know, they're so connected with technology. A lot of people are looking for an escape from that. And I think, in a way, motorcycling, not only the custom biking with being in the garage and doing things by hand by yourself or with friends and that kind of involvement as a group, but then also biking itself, getting out on the road. And half of my work is really photographing the lifestyle, which is kind of the photography that I'm hanging here today.
Yeah. This is a Motorcycles as Art exhibition. It is at the Sturgis Buffalo Chip during the rally. It runs through Wednesday, August 11th, 2 to 10 each day. Photographer Michael Lichter, it's been a pleasure to have you on the program. We look forward to seeing your art in person. Thanks so much for being here.
Could I clarify the time just a bit?
Yeah, quickly, yep.
Sunday, the show opens at noon, and it closes at 4:30 on Sunday, and it's absolutely free to the public. You do not need a Buffalo Chip pass. It's at the East Gate in the Event Center Gallery.
All right. Thank you for that. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.